From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, filling in for Terry Gross, but today we feature Terry's interviews with two different writers. Walter Kern says he used to be an eager beaver for the Mormon Church. He was 12 years old when missionaries came to the door and converted his family. Now he's trying to figure out what appealed to him about religion and why he got out. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Walter Kern. Later, The Pugilist at Rest. We talk with writer and former boxer Tom Jones about his book of short stories, which has some critics comparing him to Raymond Carver, and which has just been nominated for a National Book Award. And TV critic David Biancoli previews the season premiere of L.A. Law. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has declared tomorrow a day of mourning for those killed in the failed rebellion by members of parliament. He promised today to press ahead with plans to hold legislative elections in December, and he eased some of the censorship imposed on opposition media. Ambassador-at-Large Strobe Talbot told a House Foreign Affairs panel the Clinton administration supports the general direction Yeltsin is moving in, but he warned that support is not unconditional. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Talbot says the U.S. is happy to hear that Boris Yeltsin is renewing his commitment to holding elections for a new parliament in December, adding that Yeltsin is the best judge of how to manage the changes going on in Russia. But Talbot says the U.S. does attach some conditions to its support.
We have expressed concern on this question of freedom of the press in particular. I would not call it a criticism, however. I would simply say we have laid down a marker. I've done it here today, and I assure you we've done it in diplomatic channels as well.
Talbot testified that Russia's democracy has nothing to fear from a free press. Yeltsin has backed off a move to censor several critical articles, but Talbot says he believes 10 opposition newspapers remain closed under Yeltsin's orders. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said today that he'll visit Somalia next week in an effort to work out a political solution to the crisis there. Boutros-Ghali opposes any quick withdrawal of American troops, saying it could harm the entire humanitarian mission. A Secret Service agent has testified in federal court in New York that a yellow van that he saw in the World Trade Center garage moments before last February's bombing might have been a government vehicle. The agent appeared on the third day of the trial of four men accused in the bombing. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Secret Service agent Jan Gilhooly surprised many people in the courtroom yesterday by saying he had seen a yellow van on the B2 level of the garage right before the explosion. The prosecution maintains that a rented Ryder van was used to carry the bomb, but until now no one has claimed to have seen such a vehicle in the garage. Under cross-examination today, Gilhooly, who works at the Trade Center, acknowledged that he often saw yellow vans in the garage, including some owned by the Port Authority, which runs the World Trade Center. And he said the van he saw that day could have been one owned by that agency. Also today, another Secret Service agent, Brenda Russillo, said Gilhooly had told her about seeing the van in the days after the bombing. The defense maintains that Gilhooly's account is not credible because he apparently never mentioned it to FBI investigators. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 12 points to close at 3,599. This is NPR News. 68 anti-abortion demonstrators were arrested today in Washington for blocking access to the office of Senator Edward Kennedy. The Massachusetts Democrat is the sponsor of a bill that would limit the activities of protesters at clinics where abortions are performed. The legislation was prompted by recent violence at some clinics, including the killing of a doctor and 10 firebombings this year. Today's demonstration was part of a three-day lobbying campaign on Capitol Hill, organized by the anti-abortion groups Opposition Rescue and the Christian Defense Coalition. Chicago Bulls superstar Michael Jordan has announced his retirement from professional basketball. From Chicago, NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
Michael Jordan, who won the league's Most Valuable Player Award three times in his nine-year career and led the Chicago Bulls to three straight National Basketball Association championships, said he has achieved everything he wanted to achieve on the basketball court. and now it is time for him to leave the spotlight and spend more time with his family.
When I lose the sense of motivation and the sense of to prove something as a basketball player, it's time for me to move away from the game of basketball.
Jordan also said the murder of his father last summer made him reevaluate his priorities. He said he would miss the game, and he would miss his teammates. Jordan said right now he has no plans to return to professional basketball, but as throughout his career, all things are possible. At the Chicago Bulls Practice Center in Deerfield, Illinois, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
President Clinton signed legislation today that will allow federal workers to engage in political activity on their own time. The measure, which takes effect next year, eases restrictions established more than 50 years ago in the Hatch Act. Federal employees still won't be allowed to run for elective public office, but they will be able to hold key party jobs and work for candidates on their own time. Some Republicans fear the new law will benefit Democrats who have the support of federal employee unions. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon. Walter Kern writes, "When you can see things others can't, children in the womb, the hand of God, they call you a fanatic. But you know better what you are, a person with a vision." That's from Kern's novel, She Needed Me. It's written from the point of view of a young man who has joined a cult-like anti-abortion group called the Conscience Squad. He falls in love with a woman he's trying to prevent from having an abortion. Kern describes this as a novel about religion and redemption. And he writes about religion in all of its most unusual contemporary manifestations, including cable TV shows and Christian cosmetics companies that sell door-to-door. Kern grew up in a Mormon family in a Lutheran town in Minnesota. She Needed Me is his first novel. It's just come out in paperback. Kern writes for many magazines and is a regular columnist for Elle magazine. Terry Gross spoke with Walter Kern after the publication of She Needed Me. Here is Walter Kern reading from the opening chapter.
"As members of the Conscience Squad, we kept ourselves in a constant state of readiness, sleeping lightly, shoes beside our beds. We never knew when the call would come. A few of us, myself included, had lost good jobs because of this, not even having time to call in sick as we hustled into our clothes and out the door. On mornings when the school bus came, minutes mattered, excuses could wait. Lucas would honk the horn once, that's all. A second honk could rouse the neighbors, any of whom might warn the other side. If a person wanted breakfast, the school bus carried tea and donuts. Sometimes, on long trips, Lucas stopped at Burger King and ordered us malts and whoppers. Myself, I was usually too wound up to eat. My job was distributing the literature, snipping the twine on the heavy bales of pamphlets and passing them around to members before we reached the Target clinic. The slicker handouts, the ones with color photos showing the disturbing, bloody truth of what our opponents called the procedure, were obtained from a national clearinghouse in Georgia. The tracts that were made up of Bible verses and quotes from remorseful abortionists we produced ourselves. For its boldness and disciplined organization, the Conscience Squad had received citations from public figures too numerous to name, including a Catholic archbishop and a U.S. senator. It was the first group I had been a part of that actually stood for something, some idea. There were rumors that even the governor supported us, although his advisors would not let him say so for fear of offending liberal special interests. I was very proud to be a member."
Walter Kern, the main character in your novel is Weaver Walquist, and I wonder if he's somebody who you think you might have become at some point?
I think he was someone I was briefly, and someone my brother was. I grew up a Mormon, and like Weaver, I had a very set idea as a teenager about what was right and wrong. You know, it's amazing how young people can be more judgmental than any other age group. And I was a very young, rigid, Republican, religious type at one time.
Was there something you really wanted to understand by writing this book?
Yeah, there was. I, first of all, in writing about a member of the so-called religious right, wanted to understand a group which I think is barely described in any of our popular culture. And I wanted to understand what its appeal had been to me personally, because I was I was an eager beaver as a Mormon. I was ready to convert the world, and I wanted to understand how I got into it and how I got out of it, because I did get out of it. If anything, I'm a member of the media elite now rather than a Mormon, which is a strange transformation.
Your parents were Mormons?
We were converted. There's a story in my first book which is oddly biographical in that it seems too strange for reality, but Mormons came to the door one day, knocked, my father let them in, and they virtually took over our lives with our permission. We were in a fairly screwed up familial situation, and they solved our problems for us and made us members of their church, and I don't know whether or not I look back on it fondly or not. I just remember it as an amazing transformation.
How old were you?
12, 13 years old.
What were the big problems in the family, and what did the Mormon Church do to change them?
Well, we use the word dysfunctional now, and I suppose that every behavior we put under the heading of dysfunctional, my family was suffering from. There was drinking, there was fighting between the parents, there was fighting between the kids, and all of a sudden it was as though the angel of God came down to bring peace to us, as these religious people can do. They really have the ability to change people's lives, at least briefly, and that's why they're so successful.
So as a young Mormon boy, what did you do to be active in the church? What was new in your life?
Oh, you have to become literate in a whole new tradition, especially if you've come from a sort of secular, unreligious background. You start reading the Bible. You start entering contests concerning your knowledge of the Bible. You start regulating your behavior in a new way, your sexual behavior. For example, as a teenager, there were a lot of strictures on my behavior, which I happily agreed and went along with. And going to be in a group every weekend, I think that was the biggest change. You know, Americans are more and more not in groups and do everything by themselves at home. And suddenly we were going to sit in a room every week with hundreds of people, and not just once a week, but several times a week. And they were my family, I was told. And I hadn't had a family that big before, and I can tell you it was a interesting and refreshing change from the sort of isolation of the suburban nuclear family into this great ecstatic group of people. Oh, boy, I didn't even want to watch television.
Now, in the area where you grew up in Minnesota, I think it was predominantly Lutheran?
Yeah.
So were you considered kind of freakish being Mormon in a predominantly Lutheran area?
Well, we were converted during a brief stay in Phoenix, Arizona, and we came back with our Mormonism on our back. It's a kind of a Western more than a Midwestern religion, and we continued to practice it in Minnesota, but it was strange. Whereas the Mormons had been a majority in a way, or at least a huge group in Phoenix, they were a tiny, struggling minority in Minnesota, and it was never quite the same once we moved back. That sense of being connected to everyone went away, and I felt like we were a group of freaks, misunderstood, disliked.
You were 12 when your family was converted to and became Mormons. So just about the point that you were going through puberty, your family becomes very religious.
At precisely the point. Sometimes I think it was a conspiracy to prevent me from using my newfound hormones.
Well, you have a story in your first book, a collection of short stories called My Hard Bargain. And the first story in there, called Planetarium, is a story about a young man who's just going through puberty, and he stimulates himself a lot, and he knows from the sermons in church that this is he knows from the bishop that this is very bad, and he confesses to it, and he's shocked to find out that he knows the exact number of times he's done it, because he can mention that precisely to the bishop, but the bishop tells him and tells all the boys to kind of keep track of how many times they stimulate themselves and to write an X in invisible ink that can only be seen in ultraviolet light. And at the end of the story, he puts up everybody's X's and turns on the ultraviolet light, and the whole the whole ceiling is lit up with X's. And I guess reading that, I just couldn't help but wonder if you were asked to do anything like that ever.
What I was asked to do in real life to end my habit of self-stimulation was much more gruesome than that story records. A Mormon bishop told me, he asked me if I did this. I said yes. And he said, well, do you imagine a beautiful woman while you're stimulating yourself? And I said, in fact, I do. And he said, well, I want you to imagine her differently. I want you to imagine that she has a terrible wound and is bleeding. And every time you see that, you'll want to stop stimulating yourself. And I went back and was stupid enough to actually try this program. I have no idea what harm it's caused me since.
That's really strange.
It's truly strange. I mean, the strangest things happen in the plainest boxes, Mormon churches and Midwestern small towns. That's been my experience. The cities are hives of conformism compared to the bizarre outgrowths of behavior that happen in the Midwest.
Yeah, well, let me quote something from your book, the town that the main character comes from. He says, underneath the small town, there were secret passageways with doors that opened on strange, illicit places.
Small towns are like stage sets, and I speak from experience. I live in one now, and I grew up in them. And they're all about putting out appearances to the neighbors. And once that's done, all heck breaks loose behind the closed doors. And I remember in the town I grew up in, Minnesota, there was illegal gambling. There were more drugs than I've ever seen since. There was sex, sometimes incest, practiced quite openly. You know, out west you have polygamous communities. Not many people know about them, but there are quite a few. Small town life is like opening a trap door and getting down in the root cellar. Strange things happen down there.
What were the sins that you were most afraid of as you were coming of age in a new religion?
Every single one of them, really. I mean, it was as though you were just surrounded by pits, and you could hardly take a step without falling into one of them. In the bishop's interview that they give you every month as a Mormon, they always ask you first, have you committed murder? Which seemed so strange to me as a 13-year-old that I could be suspected of murder. But I realized that I was suspected of absolutely everything just by virtue of being a sinful human being. And that's what's funny about religion, is it usually doesn't make much distinction between smoking a cigarette, which is illegal in Mormon theology, and committing murder. Just as it doesn't make a distinction between having an abortion and committing murder. It tends to get the trivial behaviors mixed up with the profound ones.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Walter Kern. He has a new novel called She Needed Me, and the novel is about a young man in an anti-abortion group called the Conscience Squad who tries to talk a young woman out of an abortion, and they end up on the road together. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Walter Kern is my guest, author of the new novel, She Needed Me. In your novel, the young man who becomes a member of the Conscience Squad, the Right to Life group, before he becomes converted and before he becomes a member of this group, he was a pretty wild teenager, a lot of drugs and alcohol. He and his friends would take off and write 666 with spray paint on walls, and would write destruction with a K. And what else would they write? The beast be with us, Satan rises. So he goes from that into becoming a member of this group, the Conscience Squad. Did the opposite happen to you? Did you, after coming of age as a Mormon, then end up with spray paint writing the beast be with us?
I never wrote those words. They were my wilder friends who that character is based on. You know, small town Satanism does exist. I mean, it's cuckoo, and it's kids imitating something they've heard about, but it's real. It's a strange attempt at protest that goes on in religious communities. Hey, the only rebel you've ever had portrayed to you is the devil, so when it's time to rebel, you use your idea of the devil to do it, and it's, you know, it's comic in a way, but it exists. It's out there.
Did you listen to heavy metal music?
Yeah, I listened to heavy metal music. I tried to hear the subtle hidden messages of urging me to suicide. I already knew that it was forbidden. I mean, you know, it's one of those forbidden fruits that takes on extra luster. And I loved heavy metal music. Most small town kids do, really. At some point in their life, it's all about ecstasy and breaking free and, you know, ruling the universe and dominating women if you're a man and everything you think you want at 16.
So the devil iconography really had this power.
Well, I think people underestimate the extent to which a lot of Americans see history still as this struggle between God and the devil. Just that literally. I know that, you know, there are whole groups of people who base their entire way of life on this thesis all over America, not just in the Midwest. We're not the progressive, shiny, secular society we sometimes think of ourselves once you scratch the surface.
So when you were listening to heavy metal music, were you still a Mormon or had you left the fold?
I think I was on my way out. I mean, but you have to be a Mormon to be interested in the devil. You have to be religious to be interested in the devil. And so I guess it was the transition point. But it's scary. I mean, heavy metal music listened to over headphones with your eyes closed while high on marijuana is a pretty harrowing experience. And in my book, the character just can't take it.
So when you left Minnesota?
Yeah.
And went to Princeton to go to college, how did your life change?
It was both liberating and excruciatingly alienating to go from Schaefer, Minnesota, population 500, to Princeton University, home of the... I don't know, the elite, really. That's everyone seemed smarter, better dressed, more beautiful, as though they knew where the levers were that operated the world, and I had no clue. I was watching, I felt like a guest at a country club. I felt like I had a day pass at a country club, and the security guard would come make me leave.
Can you be close to your parents after you've left the religion that they're still in?
As a matter of fact, my parents left the religion before I did. It was fun for me. I stayed in it because it was a wonderful group of young people, people to hang out with, people to listen to heavy metal music at night with. My parents, who had joined the church to sort of, I think, heal a very painful time in their lives, once that was healed, were no longer interested. A lot of people drift in and out of religion, be it New Age or, you know, more traditional.
Well, I'm trying to think of how confused they must have been. If they left the church and you stayed in it, but while you were in it, you were listening to heavy metal music about the devil with a lot of other Mormon teenagers. I mean, it's
our night side.
Uh-huh.
During the day, we wore white shirts.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to explain how complex life gets when you supercharge it with good and evil, which is, and think about good and evil all the time. You know, you just end up living a topsy-turvy life.
So how did you actually finally split from the church?
I realized that it was, in Mormonism, it's mandatory pretty much that at 18 a young man go on a mission for 2 years, spread the gospel. I wanted an education. I wanted to be a writer by that time, and they gave me a choice, and I took the education.
They gave you a choice of...
Between going on a mission and going to Princeton, basically.
Oh, and that would have been acceptable within the religion? Or did going to Princeton mean that you were leaving?
Going to Princeton, most Mormons at 18 go off and become missionaries for 2 years and then go to college. I wanted to go to college as soon as I possibly could.
So that decision meant you were out?
Basically.
When you left the Mormons, which is a very disciplined group, did you feel a void in your life? Okay, you found education, you were at Princeton, but suddenly this like structure wasn't there anymore. Did you look for that in something else?
I looked for it in writing, really, and studying. Luckily, being a Mormon had taught me to study. You got up at 6 a.m. to read the Book of Mormon and the Bible. That's a very good habit to get into if you want to be a writer. I've kept many of the same habits I had. I've changed my beliefs somewhat. And there was no real void. I mean, the figures of literature were at least as inspiring to me as the Mormon saints.
I'm tempted to ask you your impression of New Age groups and the function that you think they're playing in contemporary culture, because you touch on that in your novel too. And as the main character, he once tries something called ergonics and Aquarian rebirth, and he says he wanted to be in the place where everyone looked like movie stars without having movie stars problems.
Well, that's what the New Age seems to promise, as far as I can tell. I'm no authority on it. What I do know is that a lot of people go back and forth between the New Age and more traditional Christianity. This is not two separate groups of people. There is one great group of seekers in American life, and they shop at all the markets. The New Age is one of the religious markets. It strikes me as not being new in any way. As far as I know, since the founding of America, think positive, grow rich has been the underlying philosophy of the majority.
Do you feel that there's anything in your writing that you are in the middle of working through right now?
I'm at one of those odd, vulnerable times for a writer when my life and work totally confused. My relationships with women are totally confused, which is probably why I want to write about polygamy. An old-fashioned solution to a very modern problem, which is our inability to stay with one person exclusively. And I pretty nakedly try to work out my own problems in my books. You know, you don't get paid enough to write books to make it worthwhile for any other reason except as a kind of therapy.
Walter Kern, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay, thanks.
Walter Kern speaking with Terry Gross. His novel, She Needed Me, has just been released in paperback. This is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, filling in for Terry Gross. Coming up, some hard luck stories by former boxer, copywriter, and janitor Tom Jones. His debut book of stories, The Pugilist at Rest, has been praised for its gritty yet refined prose, and it's a contender as a finalist in this year's National Book Awards. Also, TV critic David Bean Cooley previews the season premiere of L.A. Law, which airs tomorrow night. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Sources say that President Clinton is preparing to send more troops for a short time to Somalia in order to increase protection for U.S. troops already there. Mr. Clinton is expected to announce details of his plan tomorrow. Earlier today, the president said that while the U.S. wants to end its stay in Somalia, it cannot leave before that nation is secure enough not to go back to the time when people were starving to death. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has put off for at least 1 week a vote on U.S. military involvement in Somalia, despite repeated calls by some lawmakers for an immediate pullout. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Senate leadership has bought the White House time to make its case for continued military intervention in Somalia. President Clinton says he'll meet with members of Congress before speaking further on his policy. Meanwhile, members continue to demand a clarification of the goals of the operation and a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. New York Republican Alphonse D'Amato echoed the sentiment of many members that somewhere along the line the mission changed.
Peacekeepers, it sounds nice, peacekeepers, but if you have a situation that exposes tens of thousands of U.S. service personnel in a hostile environment, I don't call that peacekeeping.
Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Robert Byrd has threatened to cut off funding for the mission, but Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell set a schedule that ensures no vote on Somalia can occur until next week. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Israeli Prime Minister Rabin and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat have announced that they are setting up four committees to start detailed negotiations on the Israeli-PLO peace agreement. The announcement came after the two men held talks today in Cairo. Laurie Neff reports from Cairo.
Prime Minister Rabin and Chairman Arafat say a ministerial-level committee supervising all Israeli PLO talks will convene in Cairo. Talks on Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and the West Bank town of Jericho will start the same day in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Taba. The overall structure of interim Palestinian self-rule will be discussed at the Arab-Israeli peace talks in Washington, and an economic committee is to be formed once its makeup and representation level are decided. Despite the fact that these were the first official substantive talks between the Israeli and Palestinian leaders, their summit was quite low-key. Most journalists never even saw the two together, and following their discussions, they held separate news conferences. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
Government officials in Moscow say that Russia needs up to $50 billion a year in foreign investment. Russian financial leaders say the funds are needed throughout the 1990s to help the nation change its economy around. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 12 points to close at 3,598. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, conservative Democrats have teamed up with moderate Republicans on a health care plan that they say would be far less expensive than the one supported by President Clinton. Under a plan proposed by Democratic Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee and Republican Fred Grandy of Iowa, employers would not be required to provide coverage, and there would be less government regulation. The plan calls for low-income consumers to get subsidies in order to buy health insurance, and Medicaid would be done away with. The plan would cost about $125 billion in new spending over 5 years, with $40 billion coming from Medicare. President Clinton has signed a bill that will allow federal workers to get involved in politics for the first time in more than 50 years. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The president signed a revision of the 1939 Hatch Act, which until now prohibited civil servants and postal workers from getting involved in political activities in their off hours. The revised law now allows federal employees to play public roles in political campaigns, including soliciting contributions. However, they may not solicit workers they supervise and must still refrain from political activities while on the job, including wearing campaign buttons. At the signing ceremony, Mr. Clinton commented on the irony that Americans have been cheering democratic reforms in Russia.
But here in our own country, millions of our own citizens have been denied one of the most basic democratic rights, the right to participate in the political process.
Similar revisions of the Hatch Act were vetoed by Presidents Gerald Ford and George Bush. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher plans a trip to Moscow later this month in a show of support for President Boris Yeltsin. The secretary also wants to take a look at how Russia is putting to use the $1.8 billion in new aid it has approved by Congress. Christopher also plans to make other stops on his week-long trip. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon. The Pugilist at Rest by Tom Jones has just been nominated for the National Book Award for Fiction. Terry Gross spoke with him this summer. Here's that interview.
Boxing and war are the main subjects of Tom Jones' first book of short stories. It's been getting rave reviews. Tom McGuane in the New York Times wrote, "Writers as good as Tom Jones appear but rarely." In Time magazine, his book was praised as a sheaf of extraordinary short stories about scarred, damaged men on the far side of violence. Jones started publishing only recently, but he's not a young writer. He's 48. When he started writing years ago, no one would publish him, so he gave up until recently. In the interim, he made a living as a janitor and ad copywriter. Like some of the characters in his stories, Jones was a Marine. When he was in the Marines, he was a boxer. He gave up boxing at about the time he developed epilepsy. That period of his life is the basis of this story, The Black Lights.
I was sent to Pendleton's neuropsych facility, that bleak, austere nut house, some weeks after defending my title as the 1st Marine Division middleweight champ in a boxing smoker at Camp Las Pulgas. I lost on a KO. My injuries resulted in a shocking loss of weight, headaches, double vision, and strange, otherworldly spells. EEG readings taken at the hospital indicated that I had a lesion on my left temporal lobe from a punch to the temple that had put me out cold for over an hour. I was a boxer with over 150 fights, and I had taken a lot of shots, but this last punch was the hardest I had ever received and the first punch ever to put me down. I had seen stars before from big punches. I had seen pinwheels. But after that shot to the temple, I saw the worst things you ever see in boxing. I saw the black lights.
Tom, what are the black lights?
Black lights are a common term in boxing, and people report having seen them many times after they've suffered a knockout. And I saw them just once, and it was sort of like getting swept up in this black vortex of hell. Where everything just, it seemed to me that I was dead and in hell and in the grasp of the devil. It was a hopeless, horrible feeling, and I can't even tell you how long it lasted. It was probably only a couple of seconds because I wasn't really even down on the canvas. I was, you know, on my feet and then awake again and boxing, you know.
Where had the blow landed?
On my left temple.
Were you out unconscious after that?
No, just for a few seconds. And that's another common thing. A lot of times you'll get tagged pretty good, and you'll miss a second, but you're still on your feet and you're still doing things. Or I've heard other fighters say, "Well, yeah, I don't remember anything after the second round," and they'll have won a fight in five rounds or something. It's a concussion, who knows.
Did you stay in the fight after you saw the black lights?
Yeah. It's too bad I did, but I did.
Now, is that the blow that you think was responsible for the epilepsy that you later got?
Well, I think after that time, I never really, I was, you know, the fear of God was in me after that, and I never really wanted to get in beyond sparring. Which I still like to do, but you always will, as a boxer, find somebody that's going to be so much better than you are, and then you just, one loss is usually all it takes, and you're frightened to do it anymore, because you've taken a beating, and it just sort of finishes you. Boxers only lose a couple of fights if they can stand to do that. It's a terrible kind of annihilation that occurs when you lose. It's a mental and physical thing both, and I guess it's sort of like playing some horrible, chess tournament and losing. You're annihilated when you lose, and so you never really feel quite the same when you go in again. You remember that pain, and it comes back, and you don't want to have it again.
There's a character in one of your stories who gives this advice that boxing is the science of controlling fear. Did you look at it that way when you boxed?
Yes, it's very much a science of controlling fear, because you're terrified. The other guy is always approximately the same size, but he looks twice as big as you do. Your imagination does funny things to you. The night before you fight, you can't sleep. You go in the ring, and then it's a common saying. I think Customato said it, that fear is like fire, and if you can control it, it'll warm your house. But if it's out of control, it'll burn your house down. And so the fear keeps you in a defensive, keeps you very sharp. I mean, you get very you get very concentrated when somebody is out trying to do serious harm to you.
What about pain? You have to take a lot of pain when you're in the ring. How much?
Yes,
of that,
and I.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not a person who likes pain. If I've got a hangnail, everybody in the world will know it. But the when you're all psyched up in your boxing, there's so much adrenaline happening that you really don't feel pain. And then the next day, if you have an injury, it's that syndrome where it's a badge of honor, and it still doesn't really hurt that much. So that I never really remember too many times being hurt. Some bloody noses and sore hands. I had sore hands a lot, but I think maybe the worst thing is a good shot to the liver. That'll hurt no matter what.
Were you boxing in the Marines?
Yes, I did.
Did you do well?
Well, that's about the time that I started having the epilepsy problems, and I didn't do very well. No, I got really hurt, and I had a form of epilepsy that was didn't manifest itself in seizures. I sort of had these blackouts, much like the ones I describe in A White Horse, where I would just lose bits of time and not know quite exactly what happened. And when I got out of the service, I went to a neurologist and found out that it was epilepsy. But in the beginning, it seemed like a kind of a psychiatric condition.
Were you on the psychiatric ward at the
Naval
Hospital?
That's, in fact, where I got the story Blacklights. I was in there for about 3 weeks, and they were thinking I was sort of loony rather than brain damaged.
In that story, The Blacklights, the character says the humiliation of epilepsy had unmanned me. Did you feel unmanned by epilepsy?
Of course. Of course I do. It's a terrible thing, and I've had luck with it, though, because I had a remission that lasted almost 10 years. And then it returned in about 5 or 6 years ago in a form where I have these jerks that I take medicine for, and it controls them almost entirely. So it came back in a very mild way, and I'm glad I never got into too much of the grand mal seizures, because the people that live with those, their whole lives are just governed by that. You never know when it's going to happen. And from what I've read of Dostoevsky's epilepsy, I know that it just kept getting worse and worse as his life went on, and it just turns your life into hell.
Did it make you more introspective?
Yes. Yeah, almost like another person. Like another person came into being because of, I think, as I mentioned in the story, I've read medical accounts where it causes a kind of a personality syndrome. And one of the curious things about it is it makes you obsessed with religion and philosophy, something that I was not obsessed with. They have a thing called hypergraphia where you're compelled to write. And those things were true of Dostoevsky, and I love to write. It's funny being that you could get typed like that. I think most people with the syndrome have a very tough time because it causes depression and mood swings.
My guest is Tom Jones. His new collection of short stories is called The Pugilist at Rest. We're after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Jones, author of the new collection of short stories, The Pugilist at Rest. So were you discharged from the Marines because of the epilepsy?
Well, I got a medical discharge, and I think it was more, the diagnosis wasn't really established at that point, not until I got out and had an electroencephalogram and whatnot.
Do you think that your medical problem saved your life in a way?
Because, yes, I do. Yeah. That's why what I say about fate, because, as I said, most of the guys in my outfit were killed, and my best friend was killed. And
in Vietnam?
Yes. And so I think, well, why wasn't I? At the time, I wanted to go very much. I didn't want to leave the Marines, and I was a young guy, and I thought it would be fun to go over there. I mean, that's about how much I knew. I was not a very, very much of a thinker. I was just a regular, dumb guy from a factory town, and my friends went, and then I remember when I heard that my best friend was killed, I got a letter from his girl. She was in Paris studying at the Sorbonne. And eventually we became married 25 years ago.
It's interesting that you married your best friend's girlfriend.
Yes, very much. And that's what I mean when I say I believe in fate. It sounds kind of corny, but some strange things happened in my life. And when you look back, you think, you know, this happened and that happened, and now I'm here at this place. And I wonder why. You know, why exactly I'm here.
Was everyone in your unit killed in one battle, or did it happen over the course of their tours of duty?
Well, my friend Rolf was killed. I think he was due to come home, and somehow a bunch of Marines got pinned down on a hill, and they were all killed over a two-week period because they couldn't get in. I talked to his brother, who knew more about it, and there just wasn't anything they could do to get the guys out, and he was, I know he had a job all lined up, he was ready to come home, and he just couldn't get out. It was one of those things.
So, several of them died in the same battle?
Yes, they all did, yes.
They all died in the same battle?
Yes.
How did you get the word about that, and what were your first thoughts?
Well, It's just a terrible thing, and it's hard to really. A lot of times I think about it, and I just try to imagine it, and it's hard to do. It's really hard to do. So, I remember my wife was saying during the Persian Gulf War, when I was watching it on television, that it was Rolf's birthday, and I was watching them explain how the 1st Marine Division was going to guard, and I remember when I was 19, how pumped up I was, and thought, you know, that sounds like a, you know, like a big fun game thing to do. And now I'm watching it, I'm in my 40s, and I'm thinking, hey, that's going to be like Gallipoli, and those guys are going to be killed. I thought it was terrible. So his birthday and the war triggered me to write about Vietnam. And even though I hadn't been there, and so many other writers have written so wonderfully about the war, I just didn't think I had any right or was in their league in any way.
How did you write about a war that you didn't fight in? How did you imagine what Vietnam was like and what combat was like?
I'd been in the Marines and had been through the training, and I knew the weapons, and I heard the stories from the other Marines that came back, and I just listened. I was very curious about it, and I'd read much about the war. I read Michael Hare, and I loved his work, and I love Robert Stone's work and Tim O'Brien's work and Wallace Terry, and there were so many of them you can hardly say. But I think the definitive short story on that war was The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. And I remember the first time I read it, I thought, well, that's such an awesome story. There's just no way you can write a story about it after that story's been written. But I read it a few more times, and I thought, well, I'll write my own story anyhow. I'll write it for Rolf, and I wrote it from my heart because I love this guy, and that's how I think that's why it was a good story.
You said in another interview that you read a lot of medical journals.
Yes.
Did you develop that habit after you developed epilepsy,
or is Yes. I'm kind of a hypochondriac too, so I've always enjoyed reading it.
Doesn't it make it worse to read medical journals if you're a hypochondriac?
Oh, it makes things much worse, yes. You can't help yourself sometimes. But it's fun to read about how many things can go wrong. And we have a state library in Olympia, Washington, and it's got a great big medical section, and you can read about anything. And I just do it. I'm fascinated to do it. But whenever I have a neurological symptom, I'll get a whole bunch of stuff, and as much as I can carry, you know, out to my car and take it home. And I'll sit there in astonishment and horror and read and think, oh, God, I've got this, I've got that. When I was diagnosed as diabetic, I started looking at these terrible things that can happen to you with diabetes, and I was astonished and horrified once more. It was, and I thought, I better quit reading these. I just don't need to know that much.
Did you actually quit?
No, I'll never quit. I'll always do it.
Tom Jones, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Tom Jones speaking with Terry Gross. Jones's collection of short stories, The Pugilist at Rest, has just been nominated for the National Book Award for Fiction. The National Book Award winners will be announced in November. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel joins us with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, I understand you're leading off with Somalia this evening.
We are, and with the administration's deliberations on what U.S. policy should be. In Somalia, President Clinton spoke of meetings he's had with his national security advisors, and he says that tomorrow he will have an announcement about U.S. policy. Mara Liasson reports on that. We'll also be hearing about what some Americans down at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, who not only at the fort but in the town, think of recent events in Somalia. Also on the program today, a recounting of how U.S. policy changed when the U.N. took over there, and news of Michael Jordan's retirement.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tomorrow night on NBC, L.A. Law begins its eighth season, with a few new cast members and what TV critic David Bean Cooley calls a surprisingly strong season premiere. Here's his preview.
L.A. Law has been going downhill ever since Rosalind went down that elevator shaft. If you've been watching the show the last 2 years, you already know that. If you haven't, well, that's probably why not. Nobody at L.A. Law knew what to do with the old characters anymore. What'll we do with Arnie, the womanizing divorce lawyer? Marry him? Why not? Divorce him? Sure. Throw him into a relationship with Roxanne, his loyal secretary? Yeah, okay. Other characters were treated just as cavalierly, simply for the sake of shaking things up. And the new cast members brought in to freshen things up, well, the writers didn't know what to do with them either. The best of them, Amanda Donahoe as CJ, was wasted after a strong start, then suddenly let go. Other new players had their characters shot in the head or quitting in disgust. Given the state of things at this particular TV law firm, those weren't necessarily bad career moves. This season opener could turn out to be a critical about-face. Writer-producer William N. Finkelstein came over from his ABC courtroom series Civil Wars and starts the season by making some strong changes. Some of them are really cold, though, like the way Alan Rations, as Douglas Brackman, dismisses the disappearance of Roxanne in one quick sentence.
There's a vacant office you can use, but we're a little short-handed in the secretarial department.
Now that Civil Wars is history, Finkelstein has imported two actors and characters from that show and placed them right in the middle of L.A. law. Eli, the mild-mannered lawyer played by Alan Rosenberg, turns out to be the cousin of Stuart Markowitz. And when Eli hits town to work on a case, his former secretary Denise, played by Debbie Mazar, comes with him. Here, too, the exposition is quick and dirty. Here's one scene featuring these two new L.A. Law cast members in which Denise's husband from Civil Wars is disposed of in 25 words or less.
So you and Jeffrey are finished?
Yeah, we're divorced.
I'm sorry to hear that.
The other new addition to L.A. Law this season is Alexandra Powers, who plays a beautiful, brilliant young attorney named Jane. Nothing new there, except her character is a fundamentalist Christian, which makes for some lively and unusual dialogue. Especially when Arnie Becker, played with renewed energy by Corbin Burnson, takes her out for a get-acquainted dinner.
I was very impressed with you the other day. I was hoping I could interest you in the field of matrimonial law, working directly under me, so to speak.
Does that mean I have the job?
Well, partners still have to vote on it, but I'd say you're a pretty serious contender.
Well, maybe we better wait until they've made a decision.
Are you involved with anyone at the present time?
No, I'm not.
Well, praise the Lord as it happens. Neither am I.
It'll be ironic as well as interesting if adding a devout character to the L.A. Law mix turns out to be what saves it from terminal boredom. Until I saw this season opener, if you'd asked me whether L.A. Law could get back on the right track, I'd have said it didn't have a prayer.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlees. Research assistance from Peter Clowney. Roberta Schirock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Chris Spurgeon.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Documentary filmmakers Alan and Susan Raymond captured a family unraveling before our eyes in the PBS series The American Family. Their film, The Police Tapes, was the inspiration for Hill Street Blues. On the next Fresh Air, Terry Gross talks with Alan and Susan Raymond about their new film, set inside an inner-city elementary school. Also, Ed Ward pays tribute to Otis Redding. That and more next time on Fresh Air.